I didn't know that. It was just like on the greatest hits album that my girlfriend had or whatever.
I know,
right?
I was really into Bob Dylan in 1999. So
yeah,
really figuring
Bob
him
Dylan,
out.
The blondie of folk, folk music.
Maybe. Hey, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Nevermind the Music.
Sure is.
What are we going to talk about today, Mark?
She's laughing because this is our second try starting this episode because
it kind of crashed
it
out.
It just went. And then I think it just went off the rails is what it is. We are talking about Blondie, and their original name was Angel and the Snake. And then that sent us on this weird biblical studies rant. Let's just start over. We're talking about One Way or Another by Blondie.
I'll slip on a hip.
Yeah, is that what she says?
I feel
what
like
does
it
that
is.
Mean? I don't know. So real quick, before we're not really going to get into it, but just before I forget, rest in peace to Clem Burke, Blondie's longtime drummer, who died of cancer in 2025, April of 2025.
Wow, so recent.
So less than a year ago.
Hmm.
So Blondie, yeah. Are you a fan of Blondie?
I love what Blondie stands for. I think she's an icon for women and girls. To be powerful, but I'm not like an expert on her music or their music.
Their music. Yeah, they're a band, but they, you know, the band is clearly named in some way after, it's not quite the Dave Matthews Band, but it's like Blondie and the Blondies or whatever. Blondie, you know, it's like a nickname or whatever, right. I guess. I love this song though.
This song's good.
I love this song. I like Blondie a lot. One thing that we've got a guest to talk a little bit about things related to this next week.
Nice.
Blondie being a punk band and how the definition of punk changes by era and by context.
I love that.
Do you, like, before I said that out loud, does it make sense to you to think of Blondie as punk?
It kind of does when you put them in a timeline. Like, the time and place that this music was created was, like, antithetical of what you would expect from a blonde female, and that feels punk to me, like counterculture,
right? Because she's like a rock, like sort of sloppy vocals. It's interesting though because she's like extremely beautiful woman.
She's pretty,
made to look extremely beautiful. Yeah. Also, so she's not subverting that really.
No,
like the name fits with the image on some level.
She's like stereotypically pretty and beautiful and polished and has grit.
Right.
And when I think of punk, I think of grit.
Right.
And Blondie has grit.
I think you're totally right. But so does Janis Joplin, right? She has grit too, right? There's a lot of grit.
Is Janis Joplin punk?
No.
No.
Janis Joplin would be like acid rock or sort of blues rock, right? Psychedelic rock. It's earlier also, right? But Patti Smith group.
Mm-hmm.
Is considered punk, even though she's basically spoken word poet with music. I mean, she sings sometimes too, but part of what I'm getting at here, and we can talk more about this in our sidetrack with our guest, is a lot of this has to do with the scene, really.
Mm-hmm.
So like, if you think of the, do you know the club CBGB in New York City? Country Bluegrass Blues, I think is what it stands for. I'm trying to remember, but
I don't know.
A club, iconic club in New York City that started out playing country and folk and stuff and ended up this home base, along with some other clubs, of the early punks. And really, it was the scene. It was these bands, the Ramones, Television, and later Richard Hell and the Voidoids. The Talking Heads were considered, they were in that scene, and they were also punk. And if you listen to like Psycho Killer, like early stuff, it's very punky. But Patti Smith, spoken word, Blondie, a lot of these bands are what we would later call new wave.
Yeah.
But back then, the term punk was just used to represent the scene in the same way that, like, you would be more likely to see Iron and Wine, if people know Iron and Wine, at a indie rock festival than you would a country festival, even though, like, musically it's very Americana, right?
Uh-huh.
There's the vibe and the scene associated, at least as I understand Iron and Wine. So these bands were all labeled punk, but they all sound so different. You know, and it's like what we think of now as punk is sort of almost like you take the Ramones and that turns into punk.
Right.
Ramones and then what was happening in the UK, not the Clash, because that was also very different, but the Sex Pistols and then the Ramones is more inspirational to the sound of what punk would become than what the Patti Smith group was doing,
right.
I would
like
say.
Like when you think of like the lineage of punk, people aren't going to put Blondie on that path.
But they are, just not musically in the same way.
Right.
Now, some of their music, like this song, is kind of punk. But even when you hear their earliest singles, they're doing something different. They're more poppy. They're more, again, what we would eventually start calling new wave. Here's their first single, X Offender, 1976.
Challenge you a little bit.
Yeah.
I think if you swapped out the female vocals for a male vocal that had a lot of vocal fry and you sped it up a little bit, this would be a punk song.
Well, I'm saying it is a punk song.
Well, yeah.
It's just our definitions of that have morphed. Right. So like, I would say also you take out the Farfisa organ,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, the organs, they're losing us with the organ.
New wave sort of is like the punk energy and the punk vibe, but with more poppy vocals and more keyboards and kind of more of the kind of quirkiness that you get in like Talking Heads, right?
Okay.
If you think of like bands like the B-52s, right?
Yeah.
Whereas punk, you know, is that core simplicity, driving beat, sort of rough vocals. So yeah, but what you're describing almost is new wave. You're like, well, take this out and that, and then it's punk. And I was like, well, yeah, that's what makes it later.
Right.
Retrospectively, people start calling that new wave. But like the writing at the time, the like people writing about the scene were just calling them a punk band.
Is this kind of like the fork in the road between punk and new wave?
Yeah, I think they start out the same, and it's only later that people start, you know, and then there's post-punk and all that too.
Who would you put in like the new wave lane? B-52s.
Sure.
Who else would you put in the pile of new wave music? We have the B-52s, but who else lives there?
Right. It's tough because so many of them are ones that also, I would say, started out as being labeled punk bands. So like you could say Devo, but Devo happens at the same era. They're like mid-70s also when they start. So were they? I mean, they're like Ohio's version of punk, sort of new wave. Talking Heads also, when you think of like their later albums, like Remain in Light or whatever, not later albums, their following albums after the in the early 80s, I would say in a lot of the Police, you could consider some of the early stuff is more new wave. Part of the problem is like also some of these bands overlap into synth pop and
you
things like
need to
that.
Like have a future perspective to go back and assign them.
Right. Like
a pile.
Men at Work.
Okay.
Are they a new wave band? Kind of, but they also have other elements in there too. Almost all the bands that I would consider new wave also overlap with other genres, which is part of what's confusing about it, right? Like New Order, are they new romantics or are they new wave? Aha, they're a new wave band, but are they a synth pop band?
Right.
Oingo Boingo, I would say is new wave, but are they also something totally different from
and,
that?
Like the Culture Club is probably new wave, but also like
Pop,
right?
And so a lot of what this is kind of representative of the vagueness here and the confusingness of these terms.
Yeah.
And also the uselessness of these terms. But new wave needs to have some kind of a punk energy with some kind of quirkiness or some kind of also accessibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just experimental. It's got to have like a catchy hook or a fun keyboard synth part,
right? I kind of
right?
feel like when I think of new wave, I think of like punk with a Pee Wee Herman vibe layered on it.
I mean,
is that making,
maybe that's wrong, but maybe that's totally right.
Like,
I don't know.
I think that's what I think.
Pee Wee Herman's
like
a little more late 80s, right? So I think, right, maybe.
But just that kind of like performance art piece, like layered on top of it.
I mean, in some of these bands, like Devo, started as essentially as a performance art project.
And like
not
punk,
really
the this fork in the road for me is like punk doesn't, maybe they are performative in some way, but it seems much grittier. Where new wave seems like it's polished on purpose. It's theatrical in a way that's mindful and purposeful. And punk seems like more of a lifestyle than like a performance choice. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, it does, but... Okay. Yeah, or like Elvis Costello would be another guy that I would consider at least some of that
like
stuff.
Like there's a caricature
totally new wave
to it. For me.
I forgot what I was going to say.
It was about Pee Wee Herman. You seem like you were a Pee Wee Herman fan.
I liked Pee Wee's Playhouse. I liked dude, Large Marge scared the shit out of me when we were little. You remember Pee Wee's Big Adventure?
Yes.
The scene where the woman turns into a monster in the car?
I just rewatched all of it because the documentary that he came
out with. Is it still scary? Because it scared
It's like... I rewatch that stuff, especially Pee Wee's Playhouse, and think, no wonder our generation is the way we are.
I don't remember. I was so little watching. I barely remember
any
Pee
Wee's
Playhouse.
It is like a fever dream. Like, no wonder we're so freaking weird.
I loved it, but I don't remember much about it.
You need to rewatch it. And the documentary that he had more recently was very good when we talk about this performance art of it all. Because...
Right.
He was a performance artist.
Sure.
Beyond anything else. And that's how he quantifies himself. And it's really interesting to see like behind the scenes of it all. And I think of New Wave and I think of that performance artist piece that is incorporated more with how I quantify New Wave versus punk.
Yeah. One of the things that I do when I teach the rock history class at my college is I'll pose the question, if we think of the other things that were invented in the late 70s and early 80s, based on punk, like if punk led to new wave, but also led to hardcore punk, which one of those two styles better embodied the punk spirit, right? And it's just interesting because like on the one hand, well, new wave was punk. Like these bands were called punk at the time. It was only later that Blondie started being called new wave, right? But yet that kind of rawness, maybe the hardcore punk coming out of LA and the East Coast or whatever a few years later is more capturing up that spirit. And it's just kind of an interesting, there's kind of no right answer, which is why I asked the question.
To provoke dichotomous thinking.
Yeah, that's right. Critical thinking skills. It's
so
a gen ed course.
So dumb.
Point being though, Blondie's music is all over the place in a good way. They have so many different styles essentially they're playing with, from the punky stuff we've been hearing to essentially, I would say, kind of disco. Here's Heart of Glass from 1979. Following in the disco thing, but adding rapping.
Okay.
You know Rapture.
Oh, I know this song.
And out comes a man from Mars and you try to run, but he's got a gun and he shoots you dead and he eats your head. And then you're in the man from Mars. You go out at night eating cars, you eat Cadillacs.
I think I talked in a previous episode about how I used to work at a magic store and there was like a soundtrack that and this song was Rapture on the soundtrack to that. So it's like... I moaned a little bit because it's just like, oh,
takes you back. Did you know this is the first song with rap to hit number one?
Is it rap? I guess.
She's rapping. She's
rapping.
Debbie Harry's awesome. I don't think she's a great rapper. That tells us obviously a lot about society and the culture in 1979 when that song, or 1980 when that song came out. But it also does illustrate how mixed up this scene was, right? How diverse these bands were. But also, like, remember when we talked about the SNL documentary?
Yes.
They talked about she advocated so hard to get the Funky 4+1 on SNL in 1981. Like, the punks were into the hip hop. The hip hop...
It was, like, lovely.
Guys were into the punk music. Mm-hmm. It was... The whole scene was just, like, anything that was kind of anti-establishment.
You know, in that... same breath, could you say that rap is punk?
Sure.
Right? If you think of grit, counterculture, kind of breaking the norms, it meets those criteria. There's a Venn diagram of like what is punk, and I can't wait to like deep dive into it.
Yeah, we will.
Episode.
But before we get into this song, just more, this is how different this band keeps sounding. Their cover of John Holt's Rocksteady classic, The Tide Is High.
The kind of girl who lives up just like that. Oh no.
No, I had no clue that that was Blondie.
You didn't know that? Well,
that version,
yeah. But, yeah, I mean, that was a hit though.
Yeah, for sure. It's popular.
And there's other artists show us the connection between the punk and the new wave and the reggae, right? Like I mentioned, The Police, that's obviously there too. That whole two-tone era in Britain of ska and all that. But yeah, that's Blondie, and this is your I just found out moment.
Yeah,
this song,
uh-huh moment.
Good new wave synth pop band. to me, it's this song. I really discovered Blondie, not at all as a kid. Like I heard the songs, but when I started like listening to Blondie, or like friends would have Blondie on, I was in high school is really when it was. So late 90s. And this song comes out, and I was the other day years old when I realized this song is from 1999. I thought this was just classic era, late 70s or 80s Blondie.
I've never heard that song before.
You never heard Maria. So this was pretty well played radio song in 1999.
Dude,
when
99,
I listen to the production with my modern ear, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't sound like the 70s or the 80s. Yeah. But I didn't know that. It was just like on the greatest hits album that my girlfriend had or whatever.
I
know,
I was
right?
really into Bob Dylan in 1999. So
yeah,
really figuring
Bob
him
Dylan,
out.
Bob Dylan, the Blondie of folk, folk music.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. Kind of punk, right?
Kind of punk. Even now he's pretty punk. He's like, yeah. I don't even want your Nobel Prize. Come and find me. Good
yeah,
luck.
dude.
They couldn't even find him.
Wow, really?
They wanted to give him the Nobel Prize, and he was like, no thanks.
The Nobel Prize?
For like writing or something.
Not the Pulitzer or something?
I don't know, something. But like it was
something
like,
fancy.
Something fancy.
The Congressional Medal of Honor, something.
And he was like, nah, they couldn't even find an address to send it to him. Like, is he even, he's still alive, right?
Yeah, he sure
know.
Is. So this song, one way or another, in a long line of 70s and 80s stalker songs. This is based on her experience with an ex-boyfriend who was stalking her in the early 70s.
Wow.
Long tradition being, you know, Every Breath You Take.
Yeah. And that's it.
Private Eyes by Hall & Oates, right? Probably some other ones that maybe I don't know about. The music of this tune, though, was written by Nigel Harrison, who's the bass player in Blondie.
Cool.
On their third album, I'm just going through the data. Although not data like our Mariah episode data.
No.
1978's Parallel Lines. Does this feel like one of their biggest hits to you?
Yes.
Okay. They have four songs that hit number one, and this is not one of them, right? So this one hit 24, which, you know, it's more punk, more rock, right?
Yeah.
Heart of Glass, which came out before this.
Okay.
Wait, didn't I say Heart of Glass was 1979? I don't know. I need to check my data, everybody, my dates.
Come on.
Heart of Glass and, oh, I think the single came out in 1979, but
and
the album
why.
Came out.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Heart of Glass hit number one. Call Me, didn't play that one. Number one. The Tide Is High, which we played, and Rapture, which we played. So this is their fifth biggest song.
Okay.
But I would say maybe, like, I know it's not their signature song, probably in the sense that it's the one everybody wants to hear at the concert. But if you ask me to describe what Blondie sounds like, I think it's this.
This is, like, iconic Blondie to me.
It's something about the band rocking as hard as they rock and her rocking as hard as she rocks, but
like the raspiness
so catchy
of it.
And stuff.
Because when you play the other Blondie songs, I'm like, oh, it seems so sterile to me.
Yeah, I mean, she's a good
ways.
Singer, though. But
she's
yeah,
a very good singer.
It doesn't have some of this. So what do I want to talk about with this? I want to talk about the melody and its relationship to the harmony.
Okay.
So normally, when we have a piece of music, the chords suggest what notes the melody should be using. So for example, if we have a C major chord, the notes in that are C, E, and G, your melody is going to play a lot of C, a lot of E, a lot of G, but also do some other things. It's not bound to those notes. It's informed by the notes, but the rhythms and the actual specific notes you play are independent and free. You don't have to sing C if the chord is C. You don't have to sing F if the chord is F, right? It's just, you know, F is important to you if the chord is F, right? Here's an example. Let's go back to Heart of Glass. I just want you to listen to the bass and the chords. Try to see if you can hear the chord progression moving. And also just recognize that the melody is doing its own thing, you know, in a way that fits nicely with the chords. Many of the notes she's singing are in the chords, but some of them aren't. They're what we call non-harmonic tones, right? It's free, right? And there's pauses where there's a few beats of rest, where there's no melody at all, right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So now, as contrast, let's look at what happens in one way or another. First, let's get our handle on what the chords are, what the band is doing for most of this song. So we'll play the intro. punk with keyboards, right?
The bass player's so good.
Yeah, Nigel, he's rocking.
Yeah, he
sounds
really
great.
Is. He sounds great. I never like pulled out the bass in these songs before today. I'm like, oh, it's really
good.
Need
to play it on Rock Band or Guitar Hero.
Well,
right?
Just because you said that he wrote it, and I was like, what's his deal?
He came up with a cool little bass line, and
yeah.
That's that. So this song, though, this is the main, I could call this the refrain section of the song. Two chords, D, B.
Mm-hmm.
And there's what we call passing chords in between, but they're sort of just for fun, right? Dum, ba-da-da-dum,
yeah.
Right? They don't matter. Really, it's just two chords. They just sort of fill in the space. So what's the melody that they put on top of that? What does Debbie sing?
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you, get you, get you, get you. One way or another, I'm gonna win you. I'm gonna get you, get you, get you, get you.
Any thoughts?
She's totally following the chords.
She's noodling a bit, but she's basically, if the bass line goes dum bum ba da 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 da, she's basically one way or another.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. She's doing a, you know, one way or another. She's moving around, but she is the chord progression. The melody is the chord progression. And that's not that common, actually. Kind of weird on some level. But it's fun, and part of what makes it fun is the rhythm, right? It's exciting, it's energetic. Her tone is exciting and energetic also.
And
right?
It's like she's like, sounds so cheesy, but she's like one with the band. She's like in step with the band and really connected. And that synthesis is really intriguing, to be so connected with your musicians as a singer. It totally works.
They go even further if we go to the section of the song that I would call the middle eight. Mm-hmm. It's a little less rhythmically exciting, but she's basically singing the chord progression.
Mm-hmm. And if the lights are all down, I'll see rooms around.
This is like more like on the nose to me. Is her like? It sounds totally. Like someone else is singing too, or is it just because?
Yeah, there's like a low male voice singing down the octave. So the chords go G, B, A, F sharp, and she's singing G, B, C sharp, F sharp. So the only time she's not just singing the chord name is for that third chord. And this is a little more on the nose because the rhythm isn't funky anymore. It's just a chord, 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 chord.
You sound just like Blondie.
Yeah, I do. Well, maybe I sound like the dude in the background.
You don't have a lot of grit in your voice, though.
Oh, I can get it.
Yeah.
You should just wait till the album comes out. It's almost done.
Okay.
I don't get it low though. I've got it. She's got it when she's growling. Yeah. I get it if I'm screaming.
We need to be promoting your band more on the podcast.
I feel like people are going to tell me I need to promote my band less on the podcast.
No, I mean, we talk more about Dream Hydra than we do about Slackademic.
That's true. And Dream Hydra, rest in peace. That's why, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, I'm waiting for the comeback.
All right. Yeah. Oh yeah. Wow. Maybe Mark S will write in again. Okay, so
great. Okay.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
Does this work? Like, is it boring what she's doing?
No.
Or is it awesome?
It's awesome. Don't you think?
So this kind of thing in principle, I kind of think sucks. Like, I associate this technique for what my high school pop punk, ska punk band did, which is like, we came up with a cool chord progression and we couldn't come up with a good melody. So we just sang that chord progression, but it works in this song. For some reason, it works in this song. And that's interesting to me.
I think the Slackademics, slackademicband.com, maybe.
Slackademics band on Instagram. I don't know if we have the .com.
I don't think. Well, Slackademics band. I think the Slackademics band should do this in one of their songs.
Sing the chord progression more?
Yeah.
You know, okay. That sounds great, Nicole. But I have been mixing and working on this album for like so long. Here's the thing, people. When you self-produce your own album and when you do the engineering and the mixing and all that, I'm really proud of, we're so close to being done. Mm-hmm. But what it's meant is for over a year, I've been working on this one album.
And we can't write new music into the old music's press.
I can't write new songs. Mm-hmm. I have song ideas. I would love to write a Blondie and Sparta. I have songs in my head, people. But when I get it, I think I've mentioned this on the pod, I have to stick it in the back of my head and say, chill out, dude. You've got a lot of work to do still. So I'm almost there where I can start writing new music.
Ideas come at you quickly. You're an idea person. And it's hard. It must be hard because you're also a perfectionist and you want your album to be perfect. And maybe it never will be. But you just have to like put it on the shelf one day.
The reason it's okay, though, is that I used to worry, if I don't keep doing it, what if the next time I try to write a song, it won't be there? What if the next time I try to write an orchestra piece, it won't be there? I have learned that I'll be able to do it again.
Yeah, that's
that the
great.
Next time I'll, it's like this band. When was the last time I wrote a pop song? Oh, they came easy. I'm happy with my songs. It was exciting again.
Yeah.
I'm not worried that spending all my time doing music producing and podcasting, when it comes time, when I finally let myself write another song, a new song for the band or for a commission or whatever, I'll have it. I'm not worried about it.
Yeah.
And that's so nice because that, used to be a real fear.
Well, you've developed like a certain level of creative resilience that you know that it's always going to live inside you no matter what.
What is the, so what's happening musically here? Mm-hmm. There's sort of two ways. If you remember when we talked about Kiss from a Rose, that was like, this is either minor using a Picardy third, or this is major with borrowed chords and mode mixture. There's sort of two ways we can explain what Blondie's doing in this song. And one of them is by saying this is an example of what we call monophony.
Oh, that's
you fun. May remember, listeners, when we did our three-part series on music reading, we talked about texture. Texture is the layers of instruments and voices and how they interact. So we didn't talk through all the terms, but we gave a few examples, and one of them, the most common in pop music, is what we call homophony.
I understand it. Well, it makes sense when you know the roots,
right? Homo, the same. It's when everybody's playing together. So like a uniform accompaniment. The chords are being played and the singer is singing with the chords is one type of homophony. Mm-hmm. Another type of homophony is when like everybody sings the same words at the same time. But take a listen. We'll back up. This is Maria. This is an example of homophony in the pop song sense.
So I'm confused. Homophony is when everyone sings the same stuff.
There's two definitions of homophony that are used the same term, but slightly different. One of them is if you have a choir and everyone's saying alleluia together on different notes, making a beautiful chord. That's textbook homophonic texture.
Okay.
But we tend to also use homophony as a description for sort of a song texture, which is a uniform, unified accompaniment with a melody.
So if everyone, if homophony is in one definition, everyone's singing the same stuff. What is monophony? Because that seems like it would be everyone singing the same thing.
Everyone's singing actually the same thing.
Actually the same, not like harmonically the same thing, but like literally
homophony
the same thing.
Homophony is everybody making like barbershop music or something, or like the Beatles harmonies.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Where
to
you've
me.
Got different notes that fit well together. Monophonic texture is one thing happening. So this goes way
back. It must be a hard thing for young learners to understand the difference between the two. Is it? Do you find it hard to teach this, or do people, most people just kind of get it? I think you have to hear it to get it.
I don't know. Let's hear it to get it.
Yeah.
So here's an example of, I just played you an example of the song texture colloquial second definition of homophony.
Okay.
But maybe, let me pull up an example. I'll stay with choir. Let me give you an example of the version of homophony that puts people on different notes on the same rhythm. This is a sort of choir piece, a vocal piece, but it's all Bobby McFerrin. It's called the 23rd Psalm Dedicated to My Mother. He's singing the same words at the same rhythm, different notes. Homophony.
Me lie down in green meadows. beside the still waters she will lead.
That's beautiful.
Sure is, isn't it?
Right?
Here's an example. Compare that to this, which is very old piece, an example of what we call monophony, where there's, instead of everybody singing together but singing different notes, it's everybody singing together the same notes.
This
is Ave Generosa. This is Hildegard von Bingen, who is a nun.
Hildy.
Yeah. This is 12th century. This is performed by Oxford Camerata. All the singers are singing exactly the same pitches.
And listeners, just for clarity, this wasn't recorded in the 12th century.
That's right. We've had some confusion in the past with that.
Okay.
Multiple voices all singing together. Totally different, right?
But it sounds so uniform. It is totally different.
Yeah. Monophony. It sounds so uniform also because they're blending perfectly. Right. Like you could do it. I don't want to get into heterophony, but there's ways. Think like everybody singing Happy Birthday.
Mm-hmm.
That's called heterophony, which they're all singing the same thing, but they're not the same.
No, we're not dialed in.
We're not dialed in. Yeah. And sometimes there's beautiful musical effects, like with gospel quartets, you'll get like vocal quartets where they're wrong in this amazing way, or Happy Birthday, which sounds terrible.
We just need to pick a key.
So
I have a question. I need to go back to Bobby McFerrin for a minute because I'm stuck on it. Is what the clip you played, is that more representative of his catalog of music? Because we're used to Don't Worry, Be Happy, which is like iconic, but what you played was beautiful. And
Bobby
McFerrin
is a chameleon.
You love him. You talk about him a lot.
I don't know that much Bobby McFerrin. Mm. I've heard Bobby McFerrin because I'm a musician and he's in the circles, but I've never like deep dove and gone through his albums. He's like a virtuoso vocalist who, he does a lot of jazz, actually.
Okay.
So I don't think the 23rd Psalm is representative of Bobby McFerrin, but Don't Worry, Be Happy is definitely not representative of Bobby McFerrin.
But he's really, I mean, that was his moneymaker, I guess.
Yeah, I swear, the last time I looked into this, I think the version, if you look up Don't Worry, Be Happy, the YouTube video that says Bob Marley, Don't Worry, Be Happy has more hits than the one that says Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy.
But it's not a Bob Marley song.
It's sure as hell not a Bob Marley song, but people are more likely to search for it.
Is there even a Bob Marley version of that song?
No, it's 100%. It's just
people are dumb
sort
about
of reggae
it.
Vibe from the 80s, and people are dumb, and It's just wild to me.
Like,
last
don't worry
time I
about
checked,
a thing. Is that what they're confused
Don't
about?
Worry about a thing is different.
How funny.
But no, Bobby McFerrin, I should do a deep dive. People, the musicians in our audience are listening going, how does Mark not know a ton of Bobby McFerrin?
I think that he might be a sleeper.
He's like a musical genius.
Yeah, I think he might be.
And I've heard stuff like
what you just played was like, that was from a different like galaxy.
Yeah, this song's beautiful. But again, some of it's jazzy. Some of it's got like international influences. He's one of these guys that like Mariah Carey will like jump multiple. I mean, he sang all those parts.
Well, and when we talked about Mariah Carey, you referenced Bobby McFerrin. Yeah. I was like, I never would make that connection.
Because like a lot of my exposure to Bobby McFerrin is like some like live thing that someone sends me or whatever. And it's him doing just like improvised vocal stuff that you can't even believe somebody could learn.
We need
learn,
to do a whole
sidetrack,
just like an education on Bobby McFerrin.
Maybe we need a deep dive on Bobby McFerrin.
I'm putting it on a list.
All right,
an arbitrary list that we'll never revisit. Okay.
So you heard the monophony. I played Hildegard von Bingen, and people might be like, "What the hell does that have to do with?" Let me give you a more modern example of a monophonic texture, and I'll say this is not 100% monophony because there's a drum playing too.
Okay.
But the instruments that make pitch are all playing exactly the same thing. I guess I just lost my husband. I don't know where he went. So I'm gonna
drink my money. I'm not gonna pay his rent. Nope. I love this.
Pink
is great. Also a very talented like musician generally. She's like, her voice is phenomenal. But I really like this convention in music, I noticed. The things that you play really, it feels like, I love the, it kind of feels like we're all in it together in this moment in music. Like we're all doing the same thing, and I love that uniformity.
Monophony. But
yeah, into
but
it.
Like with One Way or Another, if we say, okay, One Way or Another, the chords are going da 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 da, and she's singing da 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 da. Why does it work? It might be the funky rhythm, because mm-hmm. that Pink tune, that's So What, by the way, 2008. Da 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 da. They're playing a pretty infectious riff there, yeah. right? So, you know, it's not boring. Like, you know, the middle eight of One Way or Another, if that was the only part of the song, it would maybe be kind of boring. But what they are is unified and clear, and the point comes through.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another way that we could explain this.
Okay.
Just like with Kiss from a Rose. Maybe it's not monophony. Maybe it's cola parte.
Okay. I'm
cola parte.
Down.
Italian for with the part. Cola
aren't
parte.
They, okay.
Yeah, right. With the part.
Are
yeah, we're learning Italian.
I take notes here. Aren't
She's
they synonyms,
notes.
Though?
Similar. So let me explain what cola okay. parte is. So it's when the accompaniment doubles the melody. So like, let's say you've got a singer and you got the piano playing along, and in the mm-hmm. right hand of the piano, they're singing or they're playing the melody the singer is singing along with them. It doesn't mean that's all that's happening.
Okay.
It's a doubling. And this unifies the parts, it clarifies the melody, and in the case I mentioned, helps the singer find the notes. Like if you go to like a high school choir performance, there might be a lot of cola parte
okay.
of the rehearsal pianist playing what the singers are supposed to sing so they don't get lost, right? So here's some examples of this used in real music. This is Lascia ch'io pianga by Handel, the Baroque composer, from his opera Rinaldo from 1711. So this is homophonic,
okay.
what we're going to hear. And this is Kristen Blaise, soprano, and Voices of Music is the ensemble. Everybody's doing the same rhythm, so it's homophony.
Mm-hmm.
But the high instruments are doing what she's doing.
Yeah. Does it matter? Like, is the difference... I don't know. Let's see if you can follow this. Is the difference, like, who's in charge?
Hmm.
So, in One Way or Another, she's following the instruments. And in what... How you talk about this,
Ooh.
You're saying the instruments are following her.
The instruments are supporting the melody.
Instead
yes.
of the other way around. Does
I've
that
never thought
matter?
Of that, but I think that might kind of be monophony. There isn't a hierarchy. Really.
Okay.
It's like cola parte with the part implies you're supporting the melody.
Because even in this example, it feels like she's in charge. The singer's
they're,
in charge.
They're
and the,
following her.
They're
you can
following
tell.
Her. Yeah.
They're waiting for her to breathe,
yes.
and then they come in. They are watching her. The conductor mm-hmm. is watching her and moving her or his arms along with her breaths, right?
Right. Like, that's how it feels. So, like, in musical theater, when you have... I always like going, and I like to see musicals quite a bit, and I like sitting where I can see the conductor, because they broadcast the conductor. He's in the pit, right?
In the pit, yeah.
But they have a camera on him. And in the first, in like the lower season.
Is it usually him?
And it's usually him.
Yeah.
And
still
like,
a pretty male dominated
yeah,
part of the
but
field.
The singers on stage can see a video of him. They put it, so just in the audience, if you look back, you can see it's in like the first row of the mezzanine, the first
right.
row of the balcony. You can see like a video of the conductor because the conductor is following the singer. I don't know. I feel like that's
so the conductor is following
here.
The singer. So keep in mind,
they need to stay in sync.
This
for
is all
sure.
very different because modern musicals are done usually to a click. So
okay.
the conductor, maybe even sometimes the singers, have stuff piped into their ear. And because you have special effects happening and videos mm-hmm. being projected, everything has to be synced to a computer. And so the conductor is hearing an exact tempo. They're not waiting for the singer to finish their breath and then continuing. You know, everybody's
okay.
following the click
but
in a musical.
Maybe in like a more classical opera, like before,
right.
like that, it is a more cola parte situation.
They are following the singers, but also then the singers are in turn following the conductor. So you'll, mm-hmm. if you see like a stereotypical kind of image of an opera conductor, they're conducting way high in the air and it's mm-hmm. so, because they're in the pit
yeah.
and the singer wants to, at least out of the corner of their eye, be able to see. Because the singer might be waiting three measures before they come in. So they got to follow and count measures like the band does too, right? Like the orchestra does. But in a modern musical, the conductor is there to like produce, like run the show and manage it and cue the musicians, but they're not choosing tempos and stuff.
So
it's all to a clip.
You know how like at the end they'll always like gesture to the pit and then you give. At one time I saw Anne Juliet, which is an awesome jukebox musical. It's so good. And I was watching the conductor because it's just really interesting to me. And then they like they're taking bows and I'm looking at the conductor and like he's not on the little screen anymore. And I was like, where did they go? And they all came on stage and took a bow. And I was like, oh, they like ran up there. It was awesome.
Good for them. They didn't trip over the cables or whatever.
I don't know. It's cool.
I think you're right to highlight like Cola Parte is following the melody. Monophony, they are the same. Right?
Okay.
Na 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 na. Yeah, we're listening to Pink, but really they're all just boom.
Yeah.
Right in each other's face. So we just listened to some Handel. Are there modern pop versions of Cola Parte? Here's Pearl Jam, 1994, Better Man. Notice that this guitar part is not the same as Eddie Vedder's vocal, but it is the top line of the guitar. The high strings are supporting and playing along with him.
Waiting, watching the clock. It's 4 o'clock. It's got to stop. Tell me.
Yeah, it seems like that's more of a Cola Parte situation.
Definitely. It's not monophony, but they are supporting the vocal.
Right.
So
I get it. I can like hear the difference.
And we're not sure 100% which of these is happening in Blondie, but let me ask this question of these songs. All of these things, like I made fun of my high school band too much. Essentially monophony in our music, despite being an 8-piece with horns and stuff. We all just played the same thing.
Yeah.
But also me as a learning to write orchestral stuff or write art songs when I was a grad student, like I kind of looked down on Cola Parte. Oh, it's boring. So what stops these from being boring? And usually what stops these from being boring is some kind of contrast. So we've heard the monophony in the Cola Parte. Let's see what happens in this music later. So here's the chorus of So What by Pink.
So what? I'm still a rock star. I got my rock moves and I don't need you. And guess what?
No more monophony.
No.
It's homophony, pop song texture.
Right.
Right? What about Better Man? Here's the chorus of Better Man. Is it still Cola Parte?
She lies and says she's in love with him. Can't find a better man. She dreams.
No, it's like they split and like you follow one or the other.
Yeah, and
like
now
you make a choice as a listener.
The guitar is just sort of doing cool rock ballad finger picking, and Eddie Vedder's singing the melody, right? So it doesn't stay the same. Now, the handle we heard does stay that way, and the Hildegard von Bingen definitely stays the same, because there's a unity in that those styles of music that's a little different, that's more important texturally. So does this change? I think if one way or another stayed this way the whole time, it might not work. And what I want to draw your attention to is the things that I think are the magical moments of this song. Let me remind you what the first refrain sounds like again.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you. One way or another, I'm gonna win you. I'm gonna get you.
Okay, now listen to refrain number two. What's different? What's better?
What do I think's better?
What's different, first of all?
I think the second one has more grit to it, because when you compare the two, the first, it's I'm not going to say it's sterile. That's not the right word, but it's so like ground low. It's so accessible because it's easy to understand. And this one, you kind of can start seeing the like unraveling of it. And
so
that's really interesting.
Where's
for
that
me.
Grit though? We're thinking about the melody.
Mm.
I'm gonna get you. That, right?
Yeah.
That's not the chords.
No.
She changes.
And it's awesome.
And that's like where the magic in this song is. Now, if the song was always that, maybe it doesn't work, but she starts out so simple. And then the next time we hear this part, we get these awesome, higher, gritty notes. And those notes are different from the bass and the guitar. Yeah. She separates from the monophonic texture, or the cola parte continues without her. And it's just more free. And it's so cool there.
It's super cool. She's so cool.
Yeah. Cheers. Agreed. So
full stop.
When we get to the bridge, there's no singing, but we hear the texture itself be so much more independent and less uniform. This, at this point, it's like a different song. I think this section of the song is, if you didn't know the song well, you almost wouldn't recognize it.
Right. So weird.
And maybe this is overthinking it, but she's free at that point. That part of the song is just so different. It's not monophonic at all.
Yeah.
No cola parte. Now she's free to just do whatever she wants. And we get probably the most iconic refrain.
Yeah, she's completely out of sync.
Out of sync with the melody. Mm-hmm. And if you played someone a sample of just this song, here's what this song, that's to me the most memorable part of this song.
But it's only memorable because you have all those precursor experiences of, because the song is about unraveling and this maniacal vibe, and that doesn't exist without the measured monophony.
Yeah.
Earlier in the song. Like, you need the contrast for it to be so good.
And I totally feel like we could just leave it there, but are you interested? At the end, we actually get polyphony.
Polyphony.
She's free.
She's really broke.
And what polyphony is, although it's gentle polyphony is polyphonic music, different melodies that have different rhythms overlapping, right?
A gentle
polyphony. I played polyphony for you, and you hated it.
Because it stresses me out.
It stresses you out.
Yeah.
Sort of polyphonic, right?
It
we have two melodies.
Yeah, polyphonic spree. That's a band.
Oh,
this
is it?
This is what they were talking about.
Okay,
yes,
cool.
They do a lot of polyphony. I get it now. I don't hate it so much here because it isn't like, I like ease into it. I'm like tempered into it from the beginning of the song. And also the drum beat is so consistent. I'm like grounded in the percussion. So like if I get stressed out by all of this like polyphonic noise, I just like center to the beat, and I'm able to do that in this song.
Sure.
In other polyphonic songs that are heavily polyphonic, I often can't find a grounding, but
well,
this I'm able
it's
to.
It's still very simple, and that's part of what makes this song punk, right?
Right.
Punk. It's not, this isn't polyphony like Gentle Giant or whatever, where it's coming from like an art rock perspective.
Right,
it's,
and like it's, my
sort
headphones
of just,
are like buzzing all, I can like back and forth.
This
and
is
I
just
can't.
Sort of like chaos at the end of the song. It's polyphonic because it's just they're piling the kitchen sink on top,
right? But it works. It works like the like with the concept of the song too, which I'm really interested in.
So lots of music in a row.
Lots of music.
What do you got?
Well, I'm thinking about punk just generally. And the reason I like this Blondie song more than any other example that you played is because it has that grit to it, that like scratchiness to it. And then I started thinking about this idea of grit in general. And I'm wondering like if we're losing grit as musicians are losing it, if we're losing it as a culture, if we're losing this ability to like withstand uncomfort, or if we're losing the ability to like be comfortable in uncomfortable
grit
situations.
In, like character trait.
In character
not
traits.
In the vocal grit, in the...
But I'm also wondering like vocally, like what if you think, I know it's hard without hindsight, but if you think about what's happening right now in music, who's like the grittiest musician on the radio? Like, who's the most punk now? Do we have anything equivalent in like today's pop music? Or is it all too like squeaky clean?
I think there's a lot of clean in the vocals.
Yeah.
Trying to think who's got like really raspy vocals. You're putting like, me on the spot on that.
Maybe like Teddy Swims or something, or
trying to think who like screams a high note.
No one does that. That's why you can't think of it.
Doesn't
it, man.
Happen anymore. There's a lot more falsetto.
Right. It's like Charlie very Puthy sanitized kind of stuff. Yes. And Charlie Puth is a, you know, a great artist according to Taylor Swift anyway. I don't really know, but
shouldn't we all be listening to more or Charlie something. Puth? Isn't Charlie that the Puth lyrics she says?
Why we're wondering why Charlie Puth isn't a bigger artist.
Something like, what song is that? Anyways.
It's from The Tortured Poets.
Right. There's a lot of lyrics in there. What?
So good. But I think like then I even extrapolate more and think about, is it because there's generational differences with how much we've been exposed to help reinforce our grit?
Hmm.
I think we're a pretty gritty generation, like great in this elder millennial, exennial moment that we exist mm-hmm. in. We did have to overcome a lot. I think the millennials had to overcome quite a bit, but not in the same way. I
War
think
on about, terror, yeah, economic recession.
But even just like, you know, growing up, like think about, so you are involved in your kid's sports team.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone's getting a trophy at the end of the season.
Nope.
No.
No.
It's interesting because a generation just below them, like that's everyone got like this. There wasn't this opportunity to fail. Right. And so like, but you, like know, it, you didn't win.
Not getting the trophy because you didn't win the championship isn't failure, though.
People see it that way, though.
So, OK, so here can I rant against the trophy generation?
Yeah,
thing?
This is what I'm trying to get at.
Here's the thing. I got participation trophies when I was in youth soccer in the late 80s and early 90s.
The teenage barbershop quartet competitions.
No, never did those.
And they want to make sure everyone feels okay and accepted.
So who are the people who are saying crap like, oh, this generation, they got participation trophies, da 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 da. That's boomer shit, right?
Yeah.
That's the boomers. Who the hell raised us and were the coaches that gave us those? It was the boomers. And so it feels like one of those things where like, sorry, boomers. I know some of you are boomers and I love you, but like, it's like the oppressor condemning the oppressed because of something they caused, like blaming you decided to create the society in which you were going to give us all participation trophies back in the 80s and 90s. Don't then in the 2010s hassle like our generation
soft.
Saying it made us soft when you are the ones who did this. You also are the ones that like had us walk home from school and hang out until you got home from work. So like we had grit in certain moments, but like, sorry, I'm you riled me up a little bit here, but the participation,
I love it.
My kids, sometimes there, you go to a tournament or whatever, you get a participation trophy, but they don't just hand out participation trophies. And it's probably because us, the younger Gen Xers and
elder millennials
that are having young kids right now are traumatized from getting made fun of for the last 30 years for getting participation trophies. I didn't ask for a participation trophy when I was 9 years old. I was given a participation trophy.
Mark's so...
I'm pissed off.
Standing up.
You know why? Because I thought of this before, but this time I have a microphone in front of me, right? Nicole.
Well, that's how it goes, right? Everyone needs their soapbox.
So, mom and dad, if you're listening... Dad never listens. Mom, if you're listening, you never make fun of us for participation trophies, but I've heard many of your colleagues in your generation blame the Gen X and millennials for getting participation trophies. And I'm like, it's not my fault.
Well, listen, you know? Listen, take a deep breath. You're going to be okay. So this idea of grit and resilience and like, are we messing everyone up by not giving our kids the environment to make mistakes and to fail and to not get participation trophies and to lose the championship and go home and cry about it? And we just keep positive, like toxic positivity, them all saying it's all going to be okay. Are we effing them all up? We're noticing at college, kids can't fail. Like students have a really hard time. I'm seeing so much testing anxiety, performance anxiety, this idea that they don't want to raise their hand and say stuff out loud because they don't want to get it wrong. We're putting so much of our love is conditional only if like you perform well, do you deserve love and do you deserve attention? We're seeing a lot of that generationally. And my question to you I mean, I've read a lot of research about grit and resilience. I've led programs that are designed to teach grit, to like operationalize grit and put it in a syllabus and teach it.
Right.
Do you think grit is something that can be taught in a classroom? This like punk grit, this idea that like one way or another,
of course
we're
going
to get
through
it.
Well, it can be taught in the classroom. Like grit as described as a character trait comes from overcoming adversity.
Sure.
I think that's what grit is, right? So grit in a classroom is you failed the sight singing exam.
Yeah.
And you're going to claw your way up and figure out a way to pass the next one. So can I teach you that by explaining it to you? No, you can find it by figuring things out and learning it, right? And unfortunately, no pain, no gain a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you're born with grit. I don't think you can teach it. I think you learn it through hard lessons. And there is something to be said of like adversity breeds character.
Yeah,
so,
I think.
You know, but I think, you know, to try not to be the people that are criticizing us when we were young adults, to not be that when my kids are young adults,
right.
Like they're also facing adversity that we never experienced.
Oh, for
like
sure
being
they are.
COVID babies, right?
Yeah.
Our kids were in the classroom. The COVID classrooms that were fully remote as kindergartners.
Yeah.
And we don't know for another 20 years, we'll still be finding out the negative impact that had on their learning, their socialization,
yeah.
their psychology.
Can I tell you, I think our kids, like in the small bin of ages that they are, aren't going to be the worst off. I think the worst off are the kids that were in middle school during COVID. Because
interesting,
when our kids were in kindergarten, I think of our kids are like 10, 11, right? Friends are everything to my kid right now. And if that all went away, if she couldn't talk to her friends or see her friends, she would not be okay. When she was in kindergarten, it was really all about me.
It didn't
me.
Matter. Yeah.
It did. She just wanted to hang out with
me.
Yeah.
And I had a 3-year-old during COVID.
Right.
Too,
like,
so it
wasn't
matter.
About yeah. like what outfit you're wearing or who's hanging out with who or who's, quote, dating Hugh, which is a biggest eye roll of a
That's
thing.
That's crazy.
Right?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Mark's panicking.
My youngest is my daughter, so I'm
I
at least get
daughter.
To start with a boy for the middle school.
But it is just the developmental window of, like, how kids move from their primary groups in their families to their secondary groups is so important in adolescence.
And they have that taken away
and
from them.
And they have that taken away
the
from
schoolers.
Them. And like that's yeah. why they're so anxious and depressed and feel like non-participatory in their life because they didn't have a chance to experiment with the failure piece of failing at social interactions. And like working in groups together and making mistakes together and maybe getting into some good trouble.
Yeah,
like
right.
around town
so
riding their
it
bikes
may
being
be
punks.
That when the educational research happens in 2050 or whatever on this generation, it may be that like academically the kids that were kindergartners suffered more because they didn't learn how to read and do math well, but socially the middle schoolers and high schools had more taken away because you could kind of by the time like my youngest barely remembers COVID, like high COVID with masks, like her first year of school or whatever. Or preschool, she was in a mask. Like,
yeah,
that memory was replaced by enough new memories. Whereas if you were 11 to 16, like these formative years of your life stay with you and they were kept, you're stuck with your parents or whatever.
Oh, it's interesting because we do talk about how like in your adolescence, those are your most like vivid and core memories. You have a lot of experiences that you pin to around that time period. But I think I noticed things in my child and in kids in her cohort that are like kind of lovely outcomes of COVID. Like this idea. So during COVID, sometimes it just got to be too much. Like some days were just too much to like sit on Zoom and try to learn your ABCs while next to you, I'm teaching literally classes about serial killers and cult psychology. Like this doesn't feel healthy. And we would just take these days called brain breaks where we just wouldn't do it.
Right?
We just wouldn't log
those.
On and we just take a brain break. And she still asks for that. If she's like, listen, I'm feeling really tired. She'll say, my social battery's empty. I just need a brain break. I just need some time to like read in my room and to be cozy and like eat healthy food. And that came out of COVID for our family.
So you've unlocked some positive mental health practices. But on the flip side, from a societal level, if you talk about like, there's like health, your health, and then there's public health, right?
Yeah.
Like, are you sick or are people sick? chronic absenteeism mm-hmm. among kids at schools is skyrocketed since
For
COVID.
Sure.
And it's because not going to school is just not in my...
Right.
Like, we had a teacher strike in San Diego when I was like a middle schooler or freshman in high school or something. And I went during the strike. Why the hell did I go?
Because your parents had to work.
Because my parents had to work. Yeah. But like now we're like, we'll stay home. Like, I'm not saying you shouldn't take brain break days, but there's like a good and a dark side to this.
Oh yeah. And like, you have to go to school, but like if you've gone every day for months and months and months and you know it's a Friday half day, like you can take the day off. And I think that the work-life balance piece that came out of COVID is something I'm seeing in generations below us. That they're like, you know what? It isn't important.
Right.
Like, I can just Zoom in. I don't have to spend my whole day commuting to like sit in a meeting for 10 minutes.
Right.
Like, I think that those are positive outcomes that adults get and little kids get.
Yeah.
But like, it's the group in between, man. They didn't have those opportunities to develop grit and resilience in a social way. And we are seeing it lacking. And to go back to the question I asked, like, can you teach grit in the classroom? I don't think you can like give a quiz about like what is grit. I mean, people do it, but you can set up environments that are nurturing and offer, I hate the term safe space, but offer safe spaces or brave spaces and create manufactured opportunities for failure, create low stakes failure as part of the curriculum. Like, we're going to try something and see if it works. And then say, you know what, that did not work. Like, when I teach counseling, I'm okay, why don't you two come up here and show me what the wrong thing to say is? I'm going to be the client and I'm going to offer a problem. So what's the wrong thing to say? And we're going to like see how that feels, right? And I think those moments in my field are really important. It comes naturally for musicians because you're going to fail.
Failure is a part of learning.
Yeah.
Like, I've always bristled at, oh, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Yeah,
I'm like, that's
not
practicing.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be intentional about it, but mm-hmm. I'm going to play this freaking scale again and hope it's better or do things so that it's better the next time. But
yeah.
I'm still doing it again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, like, maybe wrapping up on this, like, I think you mentioned how, oh, do we let them fail? I feel like that's more our generation, the participation mm-hmm. trophies and all that. I wonder if this generation, it's more the lack of independence. I think if we can blame our parents' generation for giving us participation trophies, we maybe do too much with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do baseball with my kids. I play video games with my kids. I obviously like do regular parenting stuff. I read with my kids sometimes still. Like, they don't necessarily have the, like, there was a lot of just like, oh, I'm bored, Mom. What are you asking me for? When I was a kid, I wouldn't even ask my mom. I would just go figure something else to do. There's a lot of I'm bored, Dad, with kids that are old enough to know that. And so I wonder if it's not resilience that they lack because they have, honestly, they've suffered in this generation, but it's independence that we're ruining their ability to just not have to ask mom where whatever is
right.
and just look for it themselves.
I mean,
right?
I definitely... My kid's going into sixth grade. I definitely tied her shoes for her this morning.
Just to get out
the door, because we had to get out the door.
Because it's easier. And there's actually a great Ezra Klein podcast about this from this last year where he talks about, like, we're not ruining our kids by over parenting. Our kids are ruining us. Like, it's the negative mental health outcomes for our kids are actually not there. Like, our kids are doing okay.
But like, my mental load is out of control.
Parents are not, the expectation that you have to do everything with your kid all the time. Parents aren't living balanced and healthy lives.
It's true.
Because you're just like, well, it's just better if I just tie it. But like, like, what does that do to her? But what does that do to you?
Because it's like, it's my responsibility. And I say to her all the time,
it
shouldn't be. And when she was learning, my line would be like, listen, I'm not going to tie your shoes for you because all you learn is that I'm really good at tying shoes. Like, you need to learn how to do it yourself. But like, time's tight some mornings and we just got to get going, right? So part of me is like, let her pack her own lunch, let her be late if she's late, like let her take the consequences. But like, I got to get where I'm going too.
For you,
so
too. Yep.
it's a lot of balance. Like, so maybe like, I don't know, is failure punk? Is parenting punk?
I don't think...
Can we do it?
I don't think tying your kids' shoes is punk rock.
No, I'm pretty sure tying my 11-year-old shoes is not punk rock.
It's quite square.
Nevermind the Music is hosted by Nicole Vacher and hosted and produced by Mark Poppany. You can email us at nevermusicpod@gmail.com and give us a follow on social media. Nevermind the Music is also part of the Lorehounds Network. Please join the conversation on their Discord server. Thanks for listening.